What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump Sunday called intelligence reports that Russia may have influenced the outcome of the November 8 U.S. election as ridiculous, saying such hacking could have been done by almost anyone.
And I have great respect for them. But if you read the stories, the various stories, there's disputing. I mean, they're disputing, and certain groups don't necessarily agree. Personally, it could be Russia. I don't really think it is, but who knows? I don't know either. They don't know, and I don't know.
Mr. Trump told Fox News he doesn't oppose President Barack Obama's order to review cyber attacks. The Central Intelligence Agency has concluded came from Russia. The CIA said it had high confidence Moscow sought to help Mr. Trump win. Two Republican lawmakers joined Democrats in calling for a congressional investigation of Moscow's alleged interference. Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff appeared on the NBC program Meet the Press.
You don't have the Director of National Intelligence making a public statement the way he did in October without there being a broad consensus of all the intelligence agencies. And frankly, I don't know a Democrat or Republican who has heard the intelligence that would quarrel with those conclusions. So I think that's fact one. The Russians, definitely, this was not China. This wasn't some 400-pound guy in New Jersey or anyone else. This was the Russians.
In his Sunday interview, Mr. Trump also praised ExxonMobil chief executive Rex Tillerson, who media reports say will be his nominee for Secretary of State. But some lawmakers questioned his ties to Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Recovery operations continued Sunday following the collapse of a church roof in southeast Nigeria Saturday that killed at least 100 people and perhaps as many as 160. This is VOA News. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter was in Baghdad Sunday speaking with Iraqi officials about the U.S.-backed two-month offensive to retake the city of Mosul from Islamic State.
This hasn't been an easy fight, won't be an easy fight, but today I discussed it with Prime Minister Abadi. That was an excellent meeting with him, and we agreed it's playing out pretty much according to the plan that he and I have been discussing together for these many months.
Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, said Iraqi and Kurdish forces have killed or wounded more than 2,000 IS fighters defending Mosul. A Kurdish militant group claimed responsibility Sunday for twin bombings on Saturday that killed at least 38 people and wounded more than 150 others in the Turkish city Istanbul. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, visiting many of the wounded, said we must focus on the terror burden. He vowed to continue the battle against it to the end. The blasts rocked a huge football stadium. The Interior Ministry said 30 police officers were among those killed. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told U.S. television viewers Sunday he believes President-elect Trump and Israel can work together to dismantle last year's international nuclear agreement with Iran. Referring to the deal, Mr. Netanyahu said there are several options. He denounced the agreement during an appearance last year before a joint meeting of Congress. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh Sunday said he'll challenge results of the December 1st election, in which he conceded defeat, ending more than two decades of rule. His ruling party said it's preparing a petition against what it called the flawed decision by the country's election commission. Mr. Jammeh rejected the results Friday. He was defeated by opposition candidate Adama Barrow. Opposition party leader Uma Jallo said it's time for a peaceful transfer of power.
I cannot understand now why he's talking about going to court. I think he is just speaking, but we as the alliance and the coalition are not going to accept anything short of Jammeh handing over to the president-elect on the day his presidential term expires.
The Gambian leader's reversal has been condemned roundly by the international community. Macedonia has had a close parliamentary election outcome, the ruling Conservatives and opposition Social Democrats both claiming victory in Sunday's snap elections, a ballot hope that will resolve that country's two-year political crisis. Romania's leftist Social Democrats won Sunday's parliamentary election by a wide margin, will likely form the next coalition government. New Zealand's Finance Minister Bill English was sworn in Monday as the country's new prime minister in a National Party vote that was prompted by the resignation a popular incumbent, John Key, after 8 years in office, motivated by a need for more family time. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, the 12th of December, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. Gambian civil society groups are calling on Gambian President Yahya Jammeh to accept the results of the presidential election earlier this month, as he said he would.
Initially, I was surprised by Jammeh conceding the result. But his the recent development, I am not the least surprised because that's the type of person Jammeh is.
Lamin Jaju is a Gambian civil society organizer. The inter-Burundi dialogue between the government and the opposition has hit another stumbling block after the visit of mediator former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa.
The worst may be coming to Burundi. That's our worry. So we keep working on the international community, not only with the African Union, but also on UN side to make sure that, if possible, an inclusive dialogue is organized to make sure that this crisis ends politically, to avoid a military confrontation, which obviously may occur if an inclusive dialogue is not organized.
Jeremiah Minani is the communications officer of Burundi's opposition alliance, CENERED, which includes members of civil society and political parties. And a court in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe, is set to start extradition proceedings on a Rwandan national accused in his native country of participating in the 1994 genocide. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gambia's President Yahya Jammeh rejected the outcome of last week's elections after previously conceding defeat and vowing to step down. The move drew widespread condemnation from Gambians in and outside of the country. The president-elect Barrow and many Gambians who were ready for a new chapter after 22 years of Jammeh's rule are calling on Gambian president to accept the results of the presidential election and hand over power next month. Lamin Jaju is a civil society organizer who recently relocated to New York. He says that he was not surprised by Jammeh retracting his earlier concession.
I am not the least surprised because that's the type of person Jammeh is.
So you were more surprised by the fact that in the first place he had conceded?
That was my surprise. You could see in Jammeh's interview immediately he, at the time of conceding the opposition win, you could see the lack of reality in what he was saying. And I don't know under what pressure he was under, but that was not Jammeh at that time.
So what do you think happens next? And what is the plan? What are the plans among the civil society organizations that you work with and the people in general? What is next for Gambia and Gambians?
For the civil society, I am not expecting much because civil society in the Gambia is very weak. It's weak in the sense that Jammeh and his government, I mean the government of the Gambia, were not very much open, and they do not entertain, you know, the civil society coming on the platform to talk to ordinary Gambians on their rights, exposing them to understand some of their civil responsibilities so they can hold the government accountable. That space was really not created. But I am very much sure Jammeh will finally withdraw with the level of, international pressure. I mean, with the level of pressure from Gambians elsewhere in Europe and America and even in other African countries, the level of pressure they are pushing for him to withdraw. I think I'm convinced he will definitely step down.
So you're saying that international pressure might be the reason why he finally steps down, but there's no internal pressure within the population, within the civil society?
Of course. You could see recently, the level of young people coming out to definitely demand that the government is not really pushing, you know, issues towards their agenda. I mean, you know, we just had the University of the Gambia, you know, senior lecturers saying if Jammeh don't step down and withdraw, they are not going to school. They are not conducting lectures. They are not going to do any exams. Students themselves cooperating with them, and I'm sure similar things could also, you know, happen in other education systems in the Gambia, and even some very important institutions in Gambia could should follow.
Now, what is Jammeh capable of doing in terms of retaining power? What are some of the things that we should expect in the next couple of weeks or months with this crisis that has ensued?
Don't be surprised, Jammeh, to feel like anything can happen and he doesn't care. Because we have seen him flew his family outside the Gambia. You know, we have seen him recently promoting a lot of soldiers in the Gambia from very low ranks to very high, you know, positions, really investing a lot of energy to really, you know, be with him. So Jammeh don't care what happened next.
You have family in Gambia. You're keeping in touch with people on the ground, the organizations that you've been working with. What was the mood like this weekend?
A lot of people will tell you, okay, things are fine. They will tell you life is normal, but internally this is not the case. Everybody wants to make sure that there is plan B. Some of them are telling you, I want to make sure I have a lot of food in my house. You know, we want to make sure that children are well protected. You know, we want to know where our children are going to, because you never know at any point in time what really happened. But the statement that was given by the coalition team has really built the confidence of the general population to really, you know, believe that something might happen. But it has really contributed in calming, you know, the fear in people.
Lamine Jaju is a Gambian civil society activist. He was speaking to me from New York. The inter-Burundi dialogue between the government and the opposition has yet again stumbled. This after a two-day visit of former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa, who is currently the mediator of the talks. His comments received mixed reactions from the opposition in exile and the Burundi government. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Burundi's opposition was dealt a blow with the comments this week that they say shows Mkapa is biased in favor of the government. He urged the opposition to look forward to the election in 2020 and to stop focusing on the last year's polls. The former Tanzanian president told the press he was in no position to determine the legitimacy of the government of Burundi. He said that the elections were held, court cases were raised, and he said they all ruled that last year's vote was a legitimate process which has come to a legitimate conclusion. According to his comments reported in a Dar es Salaam's newspaper The Citizen, he said that ambassadors had come to Bujumbura and presented their credentials to President Nkurunziza, and that the UN Security Council resolutions recognized him as the president. Mkapa reportedly asked, "So what is this foolishness?" He reportedly said, "Critics are wasting time talking about an event that is all over." Mkapa also gave his support to the commission leading the talks. The opposition says the body is not effective or fair. It does not include exiled members, whom the government accuses of being coup plotters.
First, you know, the people of Burundi have a right to engage in an internal dialogue. Therefore, they are absolutely within their right to do that. After this, my team is going to visit Gitega, and they have given me recommendations that they think will be forwarded to the appropriate authorities. But you can't deny the people of Burundi, all the people, the right to review their history, to review their present position, to review their present institutions, even to review the constitution.
Mkapa's comments come as the chairman of the National Dialogue Commission urged the regional mediated dialogue to be conducted in Burundi. Justin Zoisaba is the chairman of the National Dialogue Commission. He says there are opposition members on board, though not those who the government accuses of plotting to overthrow President Nkurunziza. And he says the government has shown its willingness to meet with opposition and listen to their demands.
So we went to Norway, to Denmark, to Sweden. Yeah, we went. We met the Burundians there, diaspora. Okay. They are saying that they should change the constitution. And about the Arusha, they say they are also asking, is this agreement? That this agreement do not have an end. It should have an end.
Evariste Ndayishimiye is the Secretary General of the ruling party, CNDD-FDD.
because this internal dialogue is inclusive. Everyone is invited. Come who want, and who don't want, don't come. You know that there is the people outside who are wanted by the justice. Imagine if you kill someone and they say, we must negotiate how to punish me. It's impossible. And they will ask everyone, between impunity and justice, what to choose. For them, there is no negotiation because they have case.
However, the opposition leaders who are in exile warned that the situation may worsen if the dialogue does not include everyone. Jeremiah Minani is the communication officer of SENARED, or the Council for the Observance of the Constitution, Human Rights and the Arusha Accord. It's an umbrella body of the 22 political parties living abroad.
The worst may be coming to Burundi. That's our worry. So we keep working on the international community, not only with African Union, but also on UN side to make sure that, if possible, an inclusive dialogue is organized to make sure that this crisis and politically to avoid a military confrontation, which obviously may occur if an inclusive dialogue is not organized.
Observers say that if the talks are brought to Burundi, it will guarantee that those who are wanted by the judicial system will be excluded. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A court in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe, will tomorrow start extradition proceedings on a Rwandan national. Vincent Murechezi is accused in his native country of participating in the 1994 genocide. He arrived in Malawi in 2003 and currently has Malawi citizenship and passports. He was arrested on Thursday at his home in Lilongwe. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
Murekezi, who is 54 years of age, is currently being held at Maula Prison in Lilongwe. His arrest came a few days after Malawi Parliament summoned national security officials to explain how the Rwandan national obtained national citizenship and the two passports. Last month, Murekezi sued a local radio station, Zodiac, for defamation after it reported on his illegal presence in Malawi. Kigali has sentenced him to life in prison in absentia. Rwandan government officials told local media that since 2009, they have been asking Malawi to extradite him. Lilongwe Magistrate Court told Murekezi Thursday he faces extradition to Rwanda on charges of genocide. Murekezi is yet to take a plea. Gift Katundu is Murekezi's lawyer. He says the charges are just preliminary and may change.
It's just a withholding charge, so at any time they may change, or it's just something the police want to take him face, maybe before they come up with the main charge, and they're saying they are yet investigating on the matter.
Police say Murekezi also holds two Malawian passports bearing different surnames. Authorities suspect that in 2011, he may have illegally obtained his first Malawian passport, number MA078171. The document identifies him as Vincent Banda from the Mbeya area in Tanzania. Another passport from 2016 indicates that his birthplace is Kigali in Rwanda. Lawyer Katundu says he is yet to start defending his client.
They have not yet served us with the proper issues of evidence, so we cannot come up with the defense from nothing. The client, as of now, is being presumed innocent.
Malawi immigration officials told local media recently that Murekezi met all requirements for citizenship and for his latest passport earlier this year. The case is expected to move from the lower court to the high court, which legal experts say has a mandate to handle cases of such nature. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Giraffes are one of the newest additions to the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List of Threatened Species. Over the past 30 years, the giraffe population has declined by nearly 40%, according to the conservation group. Noel Kumpel, a co-chair for the organization's Giraffe and Okapi group, tells reporter Ricky Shryok that despite these drastic and worrying declines, There are still actions that can be taken to help the giraffes. She talks about successful efforts in Niger that have seen their giraffe population grow by 8 times in recent years.
We've seen it coming, but it's true that most of the public and most conservationists are not aware that the giraffe have been declining at these dramatic rates. So it is really big news that we're announcing.
And what kind of steps are being taken to conserve these giraffe populations?
Overall, the numbers have gone down by around 36 to 40%. So there were between 150,000 and 160,000 30 years ago. That's now less than 100,000. But it's a different picture across different populations. So they've actually been increasing in southern Africa. But the places where they've been hardest hit are central and eastern Africa, some of the subspecies that live up there. And they're really impacted by growing human populations, people moving around, and impacted by things like drought and civil conflict. So expansion of agriculture and hunting for bushmeat by poor people where there are no other options. So one good success story that's still ongoing is the population in West Africa, which was down to 49 individuals, and that's increased now eightfold. That's now increased to 400 individuals. It's still always going to be a small population because there are a lot of human pressures around it, but that's with concerted action by the government and with the support of local partners and local communities. So that kind of action we can repeat with concerted action to focus on giraffe. That's in Niger, and Niger is actually the first country to produce a national giraffe conservation strategy. So we're calling and supporting the development of these strategies in other countries. Been working with Kenyan government to develop a Kenyan national conservation strategy, but you need to do that.
The UN has applauded Uganda's refugee policy as a model for refugees across the country. The country is host to thousands of refugees fleeing from conflicts in the neighboring countries, including South Sudan and the DRC. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rwakarinji visited Nyamazi Refugee Settlement Camp in Adjumani District, northwest of Uganda. The refugees tell him that friendly host communities have made their lives bearable.
Music welcomes you as you enter the Nyamazi Refugee Settlement Trading Center in Iga Village of Adjumani District. Dozens of makeshift shops dot the dusty road, including one belonging to Abraham Deng, who hails from Bor in South Sudan. Deng says he was given the startup capital of 2 million Uganda shillings, or about $570, by the Lutheran World International Agency. Deng says his business has more than doubled to $1,500 in 2 years. He attributes that success to refugee policies, which allow him not only to do business, but also to travel within the host country.
The community around us, they are really very friendly to us. They are not hostile. Like, I'm doing business with the national here. I can give them my money to go and bring what I don't have in my shop. And sometimes when I go, they give me their money to bring what they don't have from Kampala.
Abraham Ngor, a refugee leader at Nyamazi camp, agrees with Deng. Ngor says most of the displaced South Sudanese were traumatized when they reported the camp in January 2014.
We were really welcomed by the community who is actually hosting us here, the Iga village. Actually, we are staying with them comfortably and we are enjoying the land. So first, by now, as I am speaking here, the life is a little bit okay compared to the time when we came here.
Deng, a father of 7, says that when fighting reached his home in Bor County, he spent 5 days hiding in the bush without his children and a wife. They were later united in Juba before crossing into Uganda. 2 years down the road, Deng now calls Uganda his home. In fact, he says he does not want to go back to South Sudan, at least not for now.
Education system in our place is not good. Also, the road network, which is the communication system, is also not good. So when I'm here now, I have to actually to increase my level, and I need my children to get good education. So my going back, I cannot determine it.
Back in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, 24-year-old Diana Fatumata shouts in Luganda, Swahili and English languages for customers. Speaking in Swahili, the refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, says she sells soda and cakes to help provide for her four siblings.
Hii business inanisaidia kwa kupata chakula, kwa kulipa renti. Nafanyaka profit ya, kama nanunua iyo crate ya soda mwe wakinunua, napata profit ya 80,000. Iyo 80,000 naweka save, na save 4,000 na naangalia gisi ya kupata ya kukula, siku tunakula, siku inasonga mbele.
Refugees in Uganda are issued various identifications and travel documents that enable them to travel within and outside the country. Reporting for Daybreak Africa, I am Gume Devs Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
And it's now time for Daybreak Africa Sport. And here is Samson Omali in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson. We begin with boxing, where Nigerian-born British boxer Anthony Joshua successfully defended his IBF heavyweight title with a third-round stoppage of Eric Molina in Manchester, UK at the weekend. Anthony Joshua, who was making the second defense of his belt, knocked the American down with a shot right before the referee waved the fight off.
Dealing with someone who's not giving you many options, so I had to create him, and once I saw it, I tried to connect properly and I managed to knock him out. The right hook can always follow up with the left hook, so two shots. But he's not a Klitschko, he's not a Hay, he's not all of these other Fury, you know what I'm saying? That's why I don't get too hyped. I took him out of there like I should, and I'm going to keep on doing it like I should, because I said I need to keep on building up the rank.
The 27-year-old now has 18 knockouts from as many fights and will now face former heavyweight king Wladimir Klitschko at Wembley Stadium on the 29th of April. Kenya defended its men's volleyball title after beating Rwanda in straight sets at the 7th East African Community Inter-Parliamentary Games that came to a close in Mombasa County at the weekend. Arthur Odera is the captain of the Kenyan volleyball team.
We have won because we prepared very well. We have very good players, and we created a good spirit of teamwork within our team and resisted all attempts by Rwanda to take the trophy that we won in Kigali last year.
Meanwhile, Uganda finished as the overall winners after winning the football and netball titles. And in football, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa have crashed out of the Club World Cup, losing 2-0 to Kashima Antlers of Japan. European champions and runaway favourites Real Madrid will face CONCACAF champions America in the other semi-finals on Thursday after the Mexican side came from behind to beat Asian champions Jeonbuk Motors 2-1 in Sunday's other game. In beach soccer, Switzerland have emerged champions of the 2016 Copa Lagos Beach Soccer Tournament after beating Nigeria 8-3 at the Echo Atlantic City Lagos on Sunday. The competition served as a preparations for the Super Sun Eagles ahead of the Lagos 2016 Beach Soccer African Cup of Nations. Switzerland are also the European Beach Soccer Champions. In athletics news, Siona O'Sullivan has hit out at the IWAF for allowing athletes to represent countries with which they have no connection. Fionnolula McCormack missed out on a medal at the European Cross Country Championships on Sunday, where she finished fifth, just 2 seconds short of claiming a bronze medal. The race was won by Yasmin Kanaf of Turkey, with Miriam Akida finishing in second, both of who are Kenyan-born athletes.
You know, it's a shame, really, that, you know, there are Kenyans so easily allowed to represent European countries, because it takes away from the race. And, you know, I don't think they're legitimately running for the country. They don't live there. They haven't grown up there. There's no connection there. They're basically being paid to run for Turkey.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, Jackson, in Washington.
And that's it for this Monday, December 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti and Rika Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a good week ahead.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Cloti, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.